Amen. Thank you, Brent, and may God bless our hearing and understanding of God's Word. I know we gave you some tough names and things today in the Daughters of Zelophehad passage, and I really appreciate you plugging through and well told in our parables as well. And for folks here in the sanctuary, I know our internet picked a really frustrating time to be acting up for our screens, but Jay, good job kind of rallying there. So I know that this may come as a surprise to many of you, but believe it or not, my kids can vary pretty widely between being kind of snippy with each other and very competitive and getting on each other's nerves.
Really?
I know. But also, right, teaming up and having a common cause and wanting to make something really work and be fun together, right? They have that whole range. And I think this is a pretty universal thing for most siblings. I know I was that way with my brothers when I was growing up. We've probably all seen it with kids in our lives. And I think that probably is just something that's part of what it's like as humans to learn how to become a family. And the thing is, my kids really do have good, supportive, strong, kind baseline for their relationship all the time. But there are times when it feels like we're having to like pull them apart from getting on each other's nerves or fighting over something that they both want. And yet, at other times, I can actually be blown away by how much they are working hard to pull for each other, to go out of their way to do kind things for each other, even if what they're doing might mean that they're putting something of theirs at risk or that they're having a little bit of a cost to themselves because they want something for the other. And again, you've probably noticed all of this with sibling relationships in your life as well, but I would say that we can see normally that the thing that tends to pull us apart more as siblings is, and bring out that bickering and competitive side, is if we feel like there's not enough of something to go around. There's not enough time from mom and dad. There's not enough attention. There's not enough opportunity for a favorite item or opportunity that they have going on, and that they have to vie for it with each other somehow. But then on the other hand, we can also see that the things that tend to bring out the really cooperative, supportive behavior is when there's a key principle or an opportunity that they want to make sure gets fully applied for everyone. I actually kind of love that the way that I can definitely know that my kids are going to be standing up for each other and being on each other's sides is if Wendy or I have an issue that we're going to bring up with one of the kids. If we're talking to one of the kids about something that needs to be dealt with, I can promise you that the other one will pop up out of nowhere and be right there to be like a little lawyer advocate and make sure that things are as fair and gracious as possible, and that then they are comforters for each other and comrades for each other when everything is done. And believe it or not, this feels to me very relatable to our main story of Zelophehad's daughters that we read this morning, and as we're continuing in our God in the Everyday for Everyone sermon series. I hope that you can find things that feel connected to your life and your experience as well, that we're learning from and being encouraged by when we find these stories of people that we don't normally get to hear about as much, and that we know, compared to a lot of people in the Bible that we tend to hear about more, they don't have the same fancy or important positions in their lives. And I really do think that this story, along with Jesus' parables that we heard this morning, have some really important things for us to hear. And we can see how God helps us live together as spiritual siblings in our faith lives in all that we do. When we meet the daughters and we see how their actions together show a healthy faith that impacted not only their family but all of God's family during the Exodus and as Israelites headed to the Promised Land together, I think one of the things that helps us notice how powerful their actions are is when we remember that in the legacy of God's people up to this point through Genesis and Exodus, as we get into Numbers, that a key feature is actually brothers fighting over an inheritance and then not doing very good things in how they treat each other to do that. It starts with the tension between Isaac and Ishmael as Abraham's sons and whether or not who will get the inheritance and all the ways that Abraham is trying to make sure that he brings on his line as God had promised, and Isaac ultimately being chosen. But then we have Jacob and Esau, both of Isaac's two sons, competing with each other, and Jacob being kind of sneaky to take what would have been Esau's normally. And then finally, Joseph and all of his brothers, another younger brother, with 11 others that he's competing with, and he's a younger one, and they were jealous of the attention that his father gave to him. And so we have this cycle of just brothers not being able to get along and fighting over each other and being unkind to each other, just doing things that we wouldn't normally expect from siblings. Now, we should notice that in all of these brotherly relationships, it is a key feature that God has this pattern of affirming the person who would not have normally gotten the inheritance if it came to a traditional legal battle in the culture at the time, to going to the older sibling, the first sibling, something like that. In our faith, we recognize that God doing this expresses how God values those who would normally be marginalized and put to the side by earthly rules. And that God is trying to remind us that we shouldn't get presumptuous or try to consolidate or only have deserved power for certain people, because then that might leave others out and keep others from thriving. But then this story of sisters that comes along in the midst of this new stage for the Israelites, going through the Exodus, thinking about going on to becoming a new nation in the future, it has this fascinating contrast to all of the brotherly strife that we've seen for the most part up to this point. It's an encouraging alternative picture of what could be possible in God's family, in the kingdom, with the community that God offers. We get to see people deciding to band together and appeal for what's right before this God who created and upholds everyone and everyone's dignity, and also a God who is powerful and generous enough to offer salvation life and have that available to all. It should also not be lost on us in this story, by the way, that the daughters of Zelophehad are bringing about a continued development of the law that's going to be passed on to God's people as having God's authority. Until they're willing to speak up for everything that had been captured in Exodus and Numbers up to this point, there is no instruction in the law that would include women as having the option of inheritance. Now, I think that we can argue very faithfully that the story of the law being given but then continually developed throughout the time of the Exodus that we'll find in Exodus and Numbers and Leviticus and Deuteronomy, right, that this is a story of God pulling freed slaves that are going to become their own new nation into a way of life that is more just, more dignifying of all, and more concerned with common thriving than the other legal systems that were their reference point at the time, and what would have normally been expected of people crafting a new legal system. But we can also admit, as we read through the Bible, that there are some things in there that would make us say, you know, there's some sort of rough expectations of how you can treat people in here. And in fact, we might expect that then God is going to be continued to work for a while, for decades, for centuries, through prophets, through Jesus, through the Spirit, to have this letter of the law from God be matching the spirit of God's values. And this includes, by the way, that up to this point, the Israelites, and really continued through here to some degree, that they were comfortable having women and daughters be kind of like second-class citizens, just like all of the other legal systems at the time. This was normal, expected. If anything, they were doing some things that were improvements on what they would have seen. But because this is true, the daughters speaking up and thinking that their case could be made before Moses and before God was brave to even bother to speak up at all. It's brave and hopeful if people don't normally see your value. And even more than that, it is full of vision of God's values and full of faith that those values would be what ultimately comes through when they appeal for things. And so, by the way, they also end up having a lot of in common with the persistent widow that we read about in the first parable today. We mainly first see the story of the daughters of Zelophehad here in Numbers 27, but they come up again in Numbers 36 as Moses and the different heads of the tribes continue to figure out the refinements of the law on this and what will happen depending on who they marry. And then again we meet them in Joshua 17, because here the Israelites are in the desert. There is no land or inheritance that they can actually receive when they're nomads. But when they actually get to the promised land, suddenly there's the opportunity to actually provide the inheritance. And so they come and they speak up again and say, hey, remember, we had this law established. You said that we could have our inheritance. Make sure you actually follow through on it. And I believe that one of the things that we can take away from these scriptures this morning is that in our lives of faith, God encourages and invites us to participate in how salvation ultimately unfolds in our lives and in the lives of others, and how God will bring God's kingdom on earth as it is in heaven. And this is true even and especially when other forces and value systems in the world try to make us feel like we're not very important and valuable. In God's kingdom, we are invited as people, even as the daughters that other legal systems would say, you don't have a place. In God's kingdom, we have a place to participate and make sure that God's values get fully executed in our lives, even in the systems of our lives. God gives us this amazing existence of salvation life and says, hey, part of the relationship that you get to have with me will be helping make my values real on earth. Sometimes it will take work. Sometimes it will take change. Sometimes it will take reconciliation and stretching of yourselves. But I have put it right there for you to be a part of and for you to contribute to as part of what our relationship looks like. So then once we hear that from the daughters and from the widow that Jesus lifts up in his parable, it may seem like there's a big turn from these stories about God's values to Jesus' next parable, contrasting the Pharisee and the tax collector. It could be fair for us to wonder, well, are the women appealing for what they want and the right thing to happen for them? Are they actually more like the Pharisee, speaking up for himself and bragging about himself and how he deserves more than the tax collector? Because the tax collector is admitting failings and kind of stepping back. So does this change how we think that God encourages us to live our faith and be a part of bringing about God's values? But I actually think that Jesus told these parables close together, and he did so in a way to reinforce and deepen the lessons and encouragements that we can get from the persistent widow and similarly from Zelophehad's daughters. It's not actually a contrast, it's a complement. To help see this, we have to admit, first off, that it's a very different thing for a Pharisee, one of the most important and powerful people in his culture, to go before God and say, I want more plaudits. I want more affirmation. That's very different compared to orphaned and widowed women who were second-class citizens in their culture, to just ask for the dignity of a sustainable life. The context of speaking up is different for each, and so we can see them very differently as whether speaking up means being prideful or being humble in each case. So what they're doing is not undermining any sense of humility. And second, I hope that we can see a common thread between the women and the tax collector, is that their faith has cultivated a clear understanding of God's values, and that they are willing to be committed to those values themselves. For the tax collector, this clarity about God's values and commitment to follow it gives him a clarity that he himself personally has not been meeting God's values and needs grace and support. For the women, the same characteristic, the same clarity, the same understanding helps them to see that the world has not met God's values, and that the world, therefore, needs grace and support. All of them are willing then to participate rightly in what is appropriate to apply God's values in each circumstance, whether it's in their own personal life or in the lives that happen socially and that will impact other people. The contrast, ultimately, is that the Pharisee does not show faith in God's values that he feels a call to participate in. Instead, the Pharisee is showing pride in his own importance, and he thinks rather than him following God, that God needs to focus on giving him more love, rather than God extending that love and transformation to all of those people that the Pharisee said he felt so superior to. The robber, the tax collector, all of those people need God's love and transformation just as much. And we would ultimately hope probably to pray for that, that they would experience that. So when we hold all of these stories together, we see regular people that we can relate to. And they're encouraging us about how God invites us to keep growing in our attempts to experience and participate in the formation of the kingdom of God. We can see the world is not as it should be. We can admit safely our lives are not what they should be. And we can say, I can't solve this on my own, but have hope that God offers holistic salvation life that includes this foundational feature that we are invited to participate with God in salvation life, coming more and more into our lives and into the lives of other people, just like the daughters did with the law and the widow did with the judge. We can see, too, that this process of getting involved in faith life and growing together like the women did is so much better and it's so much more wonderful than trying to take this posture like the Pharisee, that God should give me power and position and advantage because I think I am so great and that I don't have to worry about God's values. I don't have anything to learn. I don't have anything to grow in. I don't have anything to benefit from God's amazing gifts of the way the world should be and the life that we can have. I'm not going to worry about learning or continuing to live them or anything like that, even if I might notice that they're missing somewhere and that something could be improved. You know, if we're honest, this type of posturing that the Pharisee does takes so much effort to do that pretending. And it inevitably is just going to blow up in our faces and make us lose our own things that we can grow from and benefit from because we are finite compared to God. God is transcendent and the beauty and grace of God's kingdom is beyond us. We want to continue to experience more and more of that. It's not something that we can contain or control on our own. But we do have to admit, it's often very tempting to act like what God really wants from us is the show me how awesome you are. Before I can love you, you have to live up to all of these things first. That's what the religious Pharisee seems to believe and operate from. We can be tempted that way too. Why is that? Why do we think that that's what God affirms and not the invitation, not the blessing of continued growth? We can say that it is good and right to show allegiance to God and to faithfulness in following God's ways. But the problem is that sometimes we think that we have to show, look, I'm already awesome at that, so much so that I almost don't need God, and only then will God actually accept me. But really, what it means to have that allegiance, what it means to have that faithfulness, is to humbly recognize that we need to keep living and learning and growing into God's values as something that's beyond us, that we're still striving for, and that, in fact, we can love to aspire to and strive for because we know it is so beautiful. And this is completely different than this Pharisee pretending, you know, I don't need God's values. I'm already pretty good. Or I'm in control of God's values. I've already solved everything. And even more than if I'm in control of it for me, I should probably be in control of it for other people too. And whether or not they have access to God's love or should be cast out, whether they can grow in it more and experience that blessing from God, or whether I can say they're not good enough. I think another thing that we can really notice in today's stories is that, in fact, being in those humble positions sometimes actually makes a difference in our ability to grasp what it really looks like to participate in God's values and what salvation life that can bring transformation for us and others is really like. When we're more likely to say, I'm used to people saying that I don't live up to their expectations or they don't think that I'm that great, but that actually helps me see myself more honestly and clearly, and see the world more honestly and clearly too. And then I can see what God will ultimately do, what the possibility of God's values coming into the world will happen. It will encourage learning and transformation to what is right, and it'll undermine pride. It'll undermine whenever we try to control and take away dignity from ourselves and others, when we try to prevent thriving. In some circumstances, we will find ourselves more like the daughters and the tax collector and the widow, knowing that we are seen by others and by other systems as being not as important. And when we have those feelings and wonder if people can affirm us and understand us the way that God does, we should take encouragement that God wants us to be a part of God's kingdom, that God gives us the opportunity, that God sees value in us speaking up and making sure that God's values come about. But we should also admit that in other circumstances, we will sometimes start more like the position of strength or influence like Moses did or the judge did in the parable. And in this case, we need to be able to see that there's an example that we can acknowledge our own need for growth from God and that we can have faith that the value of what God is offering that we don't want to miss out on. And so ultimately, we want to make sure that we experience the fullness of that salvation life. I think it's really impressive to me, actually, that Moses did not come to the daughters of Zelophehad telling him that something needed to be different and say, your daughters. I've got lots of important Moses prophet crossing the desert things to do. Why are you bringing this to me? I don't have to listen to you. We've already got that covered. Instead, he was willing to say, my position of authority, my familiarity with the law, those aren't sufficient for a new circumstance that has come up. And that I want to seek out God's insight, God's input, God's movement for this circumstance. And that that ultimately brought something that was more just and more beautiful for them and for the rest of Israel. Last weekend, while we were hanging out at the City Barbecue fundraiser, thanks again to Vicki and Women of Hope for getting that going, Tom pulled me aside to say something nice about me taking care of my ankle from spraining it playing soccer a couple Fridays ago. And he told me about how a friend of his also played pickup soccer, and that he loved hearing stories about this friend was actually a very, very good player. Had played in college, if I remember correctly, right? But, you know, most pickup soccer teams, people are not as serious, they're kind of having fun, and that allows people who aren't as good, who don't have as much experience, to participate and play too. And what would happen, though, sometimes is that people would be playing and having fun, but then there'd be somebody who was out there and saying, I want to show off to everybody. I'm going to show I'm the best person. And that would be when his friend would sort of say, all right, like, I've been having fun with everybody, but now if you're going to start knocking people around and kicking the ball at people and stuff, I'll come over and I'll steal it from you and I'll show you that you're really not the best person here after. I'll kind of put you in your place a little bit. And it was a really fun story, and it reminded me a little bit of my experience that I've had playing pickup soccer before too. Because it is true that often there are players who are trying to show off how good that they think they are, and really ultimately that normally means that they're trying to show how much better they are than the other people that they don't think are as good. But in my experience, actually the best players at pickup are kind of like his friend. They're not doing things that are showy, they're doing the things that help other people improve and get better. They're doing things that are simple and effective in the game rather than glamorous. They're doing things that make it easier for all of their teammates and that help them thrive in their strengths and cover up some of their weaknesses if they're not as good. I always know someone is really, really good if they're playing on a team with people who are not quite as comfortable, and they'll play the pass every time they play it to somebody at just the right weight. It's not too fast where they're going to have trouble controlling it and then feel bad about the fact that they messed up. It's always right in line with how they're running, so they don't have to change things up or make it more difficult. And then that makes them look even better than they are because a teammate has supported them and been able to do something that not everyone can. It may mean that that person cannot show everything that they're capable of, but it makes the whole team work better and be more impressive together. To be honest, show-offs and people who think that the best way to show that they're a good player is to individualize themselves from the rest of the team, that makes the game miserable. You hardly ever get to touch the ball. People get all chippy with each other. It's just not very much fun. And I would imagine, by the way, that this is probably true in other areas of life. Maybe in music, right? If you have somebody who's really talented with music and they're in a group of mixed ability, finding ways to bring out the strengths of each other and to have your strengths complement the strengths of other people, even if you don't get to bring out all of your stuff. That ultimately helps the most. And maybe some of you have other things. I don't know if this is true in art or in other activities you may have. If you have examples, I'd love to hear them. If we think about this metaphor even more, I think we can also remember that it's really true that the best players in sports, the best musicians in a band, are not always the ones who are most naturally gifted. Or it's not the ones who can buy themselves all the best supplies or the best coaching and show off to everyone. Instead, it really tends to be the people who notice how that there's always room for their own growth and improvement. Even if I am great, I don't think that I can't still be a learner. They're even willing to say, I may be really good in this area, and that makes it seem like I'm one of the best players, but I see that there's this other person over here who's really good at this one aspect of the game that I haven't mastered quite as much. And I'm going to acknowledge how great they are. I would want to go learn from them. I'd want to continue to aspire and develop that part of my game and admit that I may not even be able to get that up to their level. They're always wanting to see the game as bigger than themselves, and they want to constantly be exploring all of the possibility and beauty in that game. or in the piece of music or whatever it is. That spirit, I think, is the same thing as what God does for us and then invites us to do as much as we can for each other as teammates in salvation life and bringing about God's values. And so I hope that as we think about ways that we try to deepen our faith during the season of Lent, as ways we try to think about connecting with each other and those around us who we could see that God's intervention in their lives could make a difference, that we can have courage if we feel lesser, like the daughters of Zelophehad had and the widow, that God invites us. We could have humility, like the tax collector, and like these players that say, even if in some ways things are going really well, I want to continue to grow and develop and know that God's values and God's kingdom is ultimately something we're all striving for. We can be team players together in that way. And I look forward to doing that together with all of you in coming days and weeks. We'll continue now in that spirit in our time of offering.